Welcome to my podcast about success, peace, and hope. Hope you enjoyed the last episode. If you did, please subscribe and share. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Our handle is Success, Peace, and Hope. All right. Thank you, Mr. Bob, for taking this interview with me. We'll be talking about success, peace, and hope, and mostly just going through some of your understanding of success. So I think the beginning of this interview, like what sparked my interest in you, was the way we were talking about how life, when we are born, we don't have sort of an understanding of what is success. Like there's like an understanding that there's a rule book of life that would entail us that this is how we are going to see, view success, but sometimes we don't know. So could you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, Stuart, thank you very much for having me here on your podcast. I think it's a very, very good thing you're doing, and I'm very honored to lead off here. I think I'm very normal American middle-class person. I had two parents, a mother and a father. I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, which is right smack dab in the middle of the country.
Yeah.
And my mother stayed at home, took care of the house and did the cooking and did the raising the children. And my father owned a small business. He owned a grocery store. And he would go to work every morning and come back at night. So it was very normal. So from the outside, it looks like it's very easy to to learn about the book of success. But the difference here is that both my parents were born in Europe. So they came here when they were very small, but they still have a culture from their parents. Eastern Europe, not very wealthy at all, just very hardworking. And so their book of success was just work very hard and just don't take any time for yourself or for vacations or anything else, because there was no time and there was no money to do that. So everything was about staying alive, about earning enough money to buy a small house and then to get along and buy a car and all the little things, which turn out to be big things in American society. So I learned basically, you know, to work hard, and I had a good life. I had, as a child, my parents were both loving, and they gave as much as they could. Sometimes people grow up and they resent their parents because they didn't give them the right instruction book, the instruction manual on how to run your life. They had a temper, or they were under alcohol or drugs or something, or they were disabled, or they worked too hard. And whatever it was, it's always very easy to blame somebody else. And in this case, growing up, it's very easy to blame parents because they're the most direct influence on your life, at least until you get into later grades in school and get some classmates that you get learnings from. But my book of success was, I thought my father was successful. I mean, we didn't have a lot of money, but we had enough. So he did very well for himself. He was very hardworking, and he had a very good demeanor about him. He had a good personality, and that goes a long way when you're dealing with a business that you deal with clients. And in his business, it was a small grocery store, so people liked to come to buy groceries, to buy potatoes, to buy onions from him, because they enjoyed coming in to the store. So it gave me a lesson in life that I learned very early, that people wanted to come and to be associated with somebody who is happy and is outgoing and asks about them and so forth. So this was one of the first lessons of success I learned in life, which was to try to be interested in other people, to try to be happy, to try to be good-natured. And I learned that from my father and my mother. My mother was that too, but she was much more quieter. And later in life, she was very ill. She had stomach problems and so forth. So she wasn't really too visible in my later life, but when I was smaller, she had the Boy Scouts, a little troop, and she had a Cub Scout troop at her house, and she did everything that you could have a stereotype, yes, because she was very anxious to be a true American. So it's so funny now that things have really changed about what measures success and what you look like, because now people immigrating to the United States always want to preserve their culture, their country. They can't wait to go back to their country to visit. They hang out their country's flags out in front of their house, you know, and they keep the language. And when my parents came here and all the way through until not too long ago, the immigrants just couldn't wait to become American. So they wouldn't talk to you about what country they came from, about their grandparents. They wouldn't learn their parents' language. There was a very strong premium placed on learning English and learning it well. So I just went through life, and I don't think I had any great prospects. It's not like I wanted to be a doctor when I was 5 years old or anything like that. I just was a happy little kid just doing what I did in life. And I continued that way for a long time. I mean, even when I went through when I was 16 and 17 and so forth and in high school, I didn't know what I wanted to do. But some of my teachers in high school, which are here in Los Angeles, said, well, you're very verbal, you talk well, you're smart enough, why don't you become a lawyer? So they proposed that, and I thought, well, why not? You know, and lawyers are nice, and they make some money, and they're looked up into in society. So I just said, okay, I'll be a lawyer. And when I started college, I just went through college saying, they asked me when I registered, what major do you want to take in college? And I said, well, I don't know anything about major. Nobody, I was the first one. Well, my brother was the first one to go to college in my family, but he's 3 years older than I am. So the two of us were the first ones to go to college in our family. And so I didn't know anything about majors and and all that stuff.
That's the same thing. Like, in Uganda, we don't have majors or something like that.
So you probably know, too. So it's a slightly different path you take when you're taking it for the first time in your family.
So
you don't have someone saying over your shoulder, oh, this is what you do here, and this is what you have to know this, and you have to know that, and you have to do. I had none of that. I mean, everything was, my parents said, well, whatever you want is okay. So when I started college, the guidance people, the ones taking the intake, said, oh, well, okay, Mr. Burke, what do you want your major to be? And I said, I don't know what I want a major to be. They said, well, what do you have a profession that you're looking at? And I said, well, I think I'm going to be a lawyer because that's what I was told in high school. So I said, I think I'm going to be a lawyer. They said, oh, well, if you want to be a lawyer, you need to take a political sci, you need to take a poli-sci major. This this major goes with this profession. I thought, okay. So people in those days just were very accepting of authority. So here was the administrator and the teachers and the thing, and they said, you're going to be a poli-sci major. And I said, okay. And that's what I did.
That is the same thing like in Uganda where like our like culturally, like elders are like always on, like know what's best. And so you don't talk about what you want, like as long as they tell you that, okay, this is what you're going to do. That is it. Like no changes in like,
So there was, it was just, and you hope, later on in life, when you look back, you hope that what you were taught to do, what you were told by the elders to do, was something that you actually liked doing. And sometimes it worked, and sometimes it didn't. So this is, to me, this is one of the major lessons that I learned in life, is that no matter what you do, be it working with homeless people or being on the stage or being a singer or an actor or being a scientist, whatever it is, you have to love what you're doing. And if you don't love what you're doing and you don't wake up every morning and say, wow, another chance to do what I get to do today and go out and do it, then you're never going to be very successful.
Yeah, that is an interesting concept of just, you know, like loving what you're doing and like continuing to do it every day. Like comparing from where I come from, like everyone like wants to be a doctor, like, you know, they want to be a lawyer because those are the professions that have been like that we are taught to us that have money. And like sometimes like you don't like, even though you don't like it, sometimes you have to do it because that's what your parents have told you that you have to do. And like here you can always change and you say, okay, I don't like being a lawyer, I can go and become a doctor.
Yeah.
In Uganda, you know, as the British system, we always only go, only like if you go through high school, you take science, arts, and that's your path forever and you can't really change.
Right.
So how do you then like make your own success? Like how do you move away from that when the life has like, you don't like what you're doing, but then you have to do what, how do you get to that place where you want to go, even though you have to start from a place where you don't like?
Right. Well, I was very lucky. I've been lucky my whole life. So that's I mean, I always feel very grateful about the fact that I had some downs in life and I've had some, as we'll discuss later. But by and large, I've always felt very grateful about my life because I've always been a happy person. So I was lucky in the sense that what was proposed to me by my elders, in this case, the administration at my college, which was Stanford, they said, oh, you have to be a political science major and take these history classes in political science and governments of Africa and Asia and stuff that I studied. I happened to love those subject matters. That's so it wasn't like I have to read this book and I hate it. It's not about biochemistry or you know.
Yeah.
Or I mean, I wasn't trying to memorize, you know,
the atoms of the world.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, you know, organic chem or something. You know, I mean, it was something that I really liked doing. So I just took to it naturally.
Yes.
I don't know what would have happened if they told me to take organic chemistry or something else,
like
physics or chemistry.
Yes. Yeah, mathematics. And
yeah, I mean, I can do it, but I don't like it. And I will just shy away from it if I have my... So I was lucky in the sense that I liked what the path was to get to that profession. But and all the way, since I was doing, and I got good grades because one, I studied and I did what you're supposed to do. But I also found out that if you really like the subject, that you have to study much less.
Than if you
don't like it.
Yes. Yeah.
And so I think I'm a little bit lazy and I don't like to just work and stay up till 3 a.m. reading and all this. So I was lucky that because I liked it, I could remember things I read the first time. So I didn't really have to study it so much because if I read it,
then
it's still here. And sometimes in political science, I mean, I hate to say this, they're going to, the university is going to think that they gave me a degree and it wasn't justified. But I think sometimes I didn't even study sometimes for exams because I was out drinking or I was out doing something else. And I would just get the book because I always bought the book because I thought that's the least I could do. Even if I didn't read it, I at least buy
at least
the book.
Have
it here.
Yeah, yeah.
So I looked at the table of contents in the book. And from reading the table of contents, I could actually answer almost every question that the teachers asked in political science. So I could make up the answer.
Oh, I see.
Just seeing the topics that the book covered.
Oh.
And I could write on that as though I had read it.
Yes. I think I know what you mean.
Right.
Like, I understand. Because that's why I hate, like, objective questions, like multiple choice questions here in the U.S. Because they put you in one thing. But like if you can logically think about something, then you can answer it.
Yes. At least you can answer it almost perfectly.
Exactly.
Not exactly perfectly.
Yeah, yeah,
so I wouldn't get all A's, but I got B's because it was close enough to the answer they wanted. So you learn these little things.
Yes.
Because I'm a little bit lazy and I'm a little bit sneaky. So, which is probably why I was a good lawyer. So, and I went through and I just went through and, of course, the next hurdle is to get into a law school.
Yes.
Because that, then you have to go through these hoops to get to eventually where you want to go.
Yes.
Because otherwise they're going to have too many people doing the job and you're not going to earn enough money.
No.
Because if you have too many people doing it, everyone's going to charge less.
Yeah.
So I decided also at this time my mother was getting sicker and at home here in Los Angeles. And so I didn't feel right about being away from home.
Yeah.
Because my brother was away. He went out of state to go to dental school. My brother is an orthodontist. So he was away from home at dental school. And my father went away from home also because of his business. So he had a business toward downtown Los Angeles. So he would leave early in the morning and come back late at night. So my poor mother, who was sick for a good part of things and needed attention, didn't really have anyone around the house.
So
I thought, well, I better, as long as everything's equal, and if I can get into a good law school in Los Angeles, I'll go there so I could stay at home and be at least a little bit there,
closer,
have somebody there.
Yeah, somebody closer, yeah.
So I was accepted to a very good law school, UCLA, and I took it, and I went through more quickly than I was supposed to. It was you're supposed to do 4 years of college and then 3 years of law school. But because I was so interested in the classes that they offered at Stanford, that I just took more classes. I took more classes in the quarter term. And because of that, I get a letter one day saying from Stanford saying, congratulations, you're graduating in the summer term.
Oh, wow.
Of a year ahead of where I was supposed to graduate. So I thought, well, how can I do that? Because I'd been accepted to go to law school in 1 year, and now they're telling me that I have to graduate the year before.
Yeah.
And it was a very difficult time in the United States also because we were in the middle of fighting that terrible Vietnam War. And nobody I knew approved of it. Nobody wanted to do it. Nobody whatever. But for some reason, every year, it just kept going and going and going. And I never could understand how it keeps going like this when nobody wants to do it.
Yeah. Who is doing it now?
Well, the military was doing it. And at that time, the government of the United States was still very concerned about wanting to look strong.
Yes.
And they didn't want to say, okay, we're not going to win Vietnam. We'll just close it and go it out. And we're sorry it was awful and close up there. Because in their minds, that would not make it weak.
Weak, yes. Yeah. It's like not a superpower anymore.
So they kept pushing. So the way it affected me was if I was not in school and if I wasn't married and had a child, I would be drafted in the army right away. So I'd have to go to Vietnam to fight.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to do that because I thought I was too young to die. I thought if I go to Vietnam, I'm dead.
Okay. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I'm going to be blown up or lose a leg or something. Yeah. Something I didn't want to have to. Yeah, and die for what?
For what? Yeah.
Because I knew at the end of this, when the war was over, everyone was going to say what we were doing that war in there. But I don't want my life to be
one of the costs. Yes. Yeah.
So I said, I better get into law school right away so there's no gap between at the end of undergraduate and law school. So a lot of things were not forced upon me, but became really important for me to do of the times that I was living in.
Yes.
So a lot of our lives are formed and focused by what the world is like, what the society is like that you're living in at the time.
Yes, that's the same thing like with me, like in Uganda, like when I finished my undergraduate, I wanted to do a master's, but then if I waited another year, then everyone is getting married and they're getting children. And I don't want to get children at this time. Like, what should I do? So I just had to apply a year before so that I don't have a gap between schools. So right away, when I finished my degree, I came to the US.
Yeah.
So then, like, I don't have that degree, that middle time where you just, like, lingering around. And then that's where the problems start coming into your life. So I understand where you say that, you know, like, sometimes the society, the place you are in, forces you into a hole, which sometimes you don't want to, but you have to go through to get out of, on the other side.
And sometimes it works out good, and sometimes it's not.
Yes.
But you can always sort of, like, twist it a little bit and move. So in any event, I had to then go back to the law school and ask them. This was in the summer, so this was only a couple of months before I started the fall term.
Yeah.
And I had to go and say, you've admitted me to this year, but because I'm graduating early, can you admit me to the class before?
Yeah.
And law school is very rigid. Their lawyers are very, and they said, oh my God, nobody's ever asked to get admitted early. So I said, well, I really need to do this because I won't be able to go to law school in that year, because I thought for sure that I'd be drafted. And so they said, okay, just sit down here. And they had me sit down in their office and say, and the administration person went in to talk to the dean, who was the head of the, and I don't know what she said to him or what they did, but they somehow, they looked at my grades, they looked at my record, and they said, okay, we can admit this.
Wow.
So she came back out in 15 minutes and said, okay, you can start early.
Wow. Yeah, that's nice.
And the assignments are currently put up on the bulletin board, so start reading them now. So I did. And I went through law school 1 year earlier than I should have. That always gave me extra time. But I thought for sure that the Vietnam War would be over. In the next year, I thought for sure they're going to see how stupid this was. And it wasn't going to ever, we weren't going to win it. And I just didn't want to die. But a year from now, they'll close it up. And that didn't happen. So I had to find something else to do, because all this time I'm trying to stay out of the army, being blown up. So just at that time, pure luck, I was offered a scholarship. To London School of Economics at LSE.
Yeah, that's one of the universities I wanted to go to because I liked economics,
And I was to study international economic law. I get my LLM, my master's in law. So off I go to London. Now, all the time I'm trying to talk to my father, who didn't have a lot of money, but he had enough. I said to him, you have to, he said, I thought I'm done paying for your college. I said, no, another year. I've got to live. And said, in London?
Yeah.
You know, my father knew me very well. He thought this was going to be a big vacation.
Yeah.
Which it was. It was. But I still learned international economic law, and I still went to London School of Economics, and I had a great time there. And so then I came out, and I don't know what happened. I did a little bit of this and a little bit of that. And somehow I stayed out of the military.
Yeah.
And then I turned, when you turn 26, the age of 26, then you're no longer
eligible.
You're not age eligible. So I turned 26 and I thought I'm okay. But so a lot of what I did and what I success, even like leading up to my adult life, was built upon circumstances that I just was born into.
Yes, yeah.
So they had nothing to do with, but the good thing about success, to get back to your topic, is that success also is realizing what position you're in, realizing what items you have and what people, what circumstances, whatever you have in front of you, and how you can make the best use of them for your own direction.
Wow, so you sort of like, try to like see the cards you're dealt.
Yes.
And then you try to see how can I play them right.
Yes.
Like sometimes they're bad cards, but then you have to still try to use them right. in a way, like even though they are bad. So that's what you're trying to tell
us. That's right. Yes. And sometimes you have to take some of those two or three of those cards that you have and throw them away, throw them down in the middle and pick three new ones.
Oh,
but
I see.
To do that, you're never sure whether you're going to get better cards or worse cards. So it's always
it's
kind
a
of
gamble.
Thing.
You're
so
gambling.
So the cards have to be really bad for you to throw them away.
Yeah, so when do you decide that these cards are so bad that I have to throw them away? Because, like, sometimes we have that say, like, in me, like, sometimes I'm like, maybe if I push a little bit harder, I can make it. If I try a little bit harder, like, I see some other person has done it, maybe I will be able to do it.
Right.
I'm just maybe not smart enough. I'm just not doing it right. When do you have that mental shift and saying that it's time to discard these cards?
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so now we shift back to you have to do what you like. All right. So I'm going through all of this stuff. I'm going to stay out of Vietnam. I'm going to London School of Economics. I'm doing this here. I'm doing that there. I'm trying to stay alive.
Yeah.
You know, somebody said to me, why don't you just get married and have a kid? And I said, no.
Yeah.
I don't want that yet. You know. So I was doing all these different things to just try to stay. It kept me very busy because I was just trying to go every place.
Yes. Yeah.
And then, so again, this is by sheer accident. This is nothing I planned or I could plan, is that I had a friend who is still a good friend of mine. He went on to become a lawyer and then a judge, appointed judge and so forth. And I'm very close to him and his family. We were going to go out, a group of us from law school, the same class. We were about three or four. We were going out for dinner. You know, let's go grab some dinner. Oh, great. It was terrific. And he said, oh, by the way, on Wilshire Boulevard in the Miracle Mile, they're opening the headquarters of Bobby Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, who was running for the presidency. And they're opening a headquarters for him to run. This was 1968. And I thought, geez, well, that's nice. And he said, I want to stop by and pick up something for myself and a brochure and a folder or something. So why don't we stop there first and just see what that looks like? And then we'll go to dinner, you know, half an hour later. Okay,
Sounds good. Yeah.
So we all went in there. We all looked around. Oh, this is what none of us had ever been in politics before or even knew what the inside of a campaign office looked like or anything. I mean, none of us had any political background. We were all college students. We went to UCLA or we went someplace else and, you know, San Diego or wherever. And we'd all just gone to school.
Yeah.
So we looked around and I said, God, this is really interesting. And, oh, I didn't know he did this. And I didn't know that's good, pretty good. And I didn't even know who was favoring, because I hadn't thought about it. And this was, you know, I just knew that I wanted to elect a president who was opposed to staying in the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
So, and he came out against the war really pretty strongly while he was running. So in any event, my friend, just because we're all like in our early mid-20s and we're still joking around in life. He said, Bob, why don't you run for, we were watching a little thing going on, a little election to see who was going to be head of a little volunteer group called Young Professionals for Kennedy, which was just a little group that would raise money and do things and volunteer. And that was just the name for it. And he said, why don't you be a member of this? And I said, oh, well, I don't know. Why not? Because I was through with college. I was through with all that stuff. And and I thought, well, maybe, whatever. And the next thing you know, they say, okay, nominations for the president of Young Professionals for Kennedy. And this guy, David's hand goes up and he says, I nominate Bob Burke. He didn't even tell me. He didn't even say anything. He just said, I nominate Bob Burke. And two of the other guys who were just goof-offs also like me said, oh, we second it. We third it. So it looked like I had the whole room in favor of me. So they said, well, anybody else running wants to run for president? And I think there were some other people who were going to do it, but I think they got
pulled out.
Yeah, they got frightened. You know, they said, oh my God, I can't win again. This guy's got the whole room for him. So they said, okay, And, you know, election over, your congratulations, you're president. And I started working on a political campaign. And, Stuart, I loved it so much. It was like God created the most perfect thing for me. I just loved being of service. I loved being active in public affairs, in politics, in Social Security, and just all the tax, everything that affects you when you're talking about national politics. And I just loved it all. Plus, at the time, I was smoking cigarettes, so you could smoke at your desk, which was, you know, now it's like crazy, but every desk had a little ashtray in it, so you could smoke, and every afternoon at 3 or 4 o'clock, a couple of the guys who were from New York, because that's where Bobby Kennedy was senator from, they said, come on, let's go get a drink, and there was next door, there was a restaurant with a little bar in it, and I would go next door, and have a couple of drinks with them. And I loved it because I was just a kid. I was 25 years old, and I had never acted in the adult world before. And I never really saw an adult world because my father would just come home from his shop and he would do whatever, he would be tired and he would watch television or something and go to sleep. So I never really knew what the adult world was like. And these guys were just doing everything that I loved. They were smoking, you know, they were drinking, you know, whiskey and, you know, martinis, and they were talking about politics, and it all sounded very powerful and very strong and very exciting. And I thought, God, this is great. And they're paying me for this. And I just became, within a matter of weeks, I just, it was
blended
like,
in.
It was just like a plus and a minus in magnetic poles. I just went like that. And it changed my whole life. I didn't want to be a lawyer. I mean, I was already a lawyer because I had law school and I had my degree and all the other stuff, but I didn't want to practice. And I was doing very well in the political world, not because of me, because I have my father's personality. So I have a personality that people like, that I go out, that I like to be around people. I like to find out what they're about. So that was all part of my background. That I didn't even realize that where it came from. But now when I look back on it, I see that I was a small clone of my father.
Your father.
So I did very well in politics. I loved it. People liked me. They kept promoting me into other things. They kept giving me more and more responsibility. And I had no background in politics, so they were really taking a big chance on me.
But you're still making, you're making your own, like, sort of path. You're creating.
I was, because I could have said, no, I'm going home. No, I'm not going
to
do this.
I want to be a lawyer.
I'm going to go to work in a law firm. I'm going to do divorces. or I'm going to do automobile accident cases or something.
You would have a billboard.
No, so I just continued loving what I was doing. And then, and then, of course, that terrible night happened at, here in L.A. at the Ambassador. Bobby Kennedy was, Bobby Kennedy was shot. He was killed. And nobody knew what to do. I mean, everybody was walking around in a haze like that. And then I get a call from Bobby Kennedy's family saying, will you come back to New York and help us work on the funeral mass at in St. Patrick's at New York City? St. Patrick's is a big Catholic, Roman Catholic church. It's probably one of the great religious places in New York. It's, you know, especially for the Irish and the Catholic. So I thought, I said, what else am I going to do? I didn't have a job. I didn't have, you know, by that time I had sort of like, I was working like 20 hours a day on the campaign. So I didn't have anything else.
Anything else like you
have? That would tie
you into something else,
And so the next morning, I got on an airplane. And, well, see, this is where the also advantage was that I had a little bit of excess money. Not excess, but I had enough to go and buy an airplane ticket. Instead of saying, oh, how am I going to get there? I can't go, and, and I can't do this, and how am I going to support myself, and whatever. I had enough money that I could
you could that. Like yes
have wiggle, option yes, have
yes,
options
yes, yes yes
so I went off and I went to work there, and I was working on the campaign. Then I worked on the funeral mass. Then they had a train from New York, where the cathedral is, to Washington, D.C., where Bobby Kennedy was going to be buried next to his brother, John Kennedy, who had been shot 5 years before.
Wow. Yeah.
So I'm on this train with everybody that I had ever loved and thought highly of. All of these people in the John Kennedy administration in the White House. And all these names. And Ethel Kennedy came up to me and said, I mean, this is like when Britain still controlled Uganda.
Yes.
Right? It'd be like if the Queen came and personally and said to you, Stuart, I really like what you're doing here, and gave you a pat on the back, right? You see, that's kind of what it was like to me. Because there'll be nobody that I'd rather have talked to me than she.
Just have that affirmation and like recognition of like what you've been doing.
So I worked. I wound up in Washington, D.C., where I had never been before. So this is where my life starts to veer off into success, because now I'm really operating in the real world with lawyers and government people and people in the White House and people in Washington, D.C., and it becomes like a whole different world than student Bob Burke in Los Angeles, California. So I went there, and they gave me a great job, very prestigious, speaking on behalf of gun control.
Yes.
Even then, that was 1968, and we were still trying to control handguns and shotguns in places. And I did that, and that set off a whole policy of working in politics, government relations, working for governors, working for senators, doing my own thing. I had small little periods where I lived in Europe, in Geneva, Switzerland, and in France, Paris, and in London, doing international finance, because I had some background from London School of Economics. Some international finance or some international law. But it all, I mean, you can't really say it was practicing law. It was just something else.
It's like you're just creating things
Like
out of the different experiences you've had.
Business, politics, and all that stuff. So I loved it, and I just spent a long time doing that. So that was from until living in Washington, D.C. And then I came back from Europe. Then I lived in Washington, D.C. for a while. Then I was working in the government. I had a friend who was the head of a big agency. And I worked there up until 19. And I got to know very well because I worked for, it's so crazy. I went to work for a governor of Pennsylvania. Which is a state, and you know, and the governor of Pennsylvania sent me to do a task to bring foreign industry into the state of Pennsylvania. To manufacture to there, to create jobs, pay taxes, and all that stuff. And in doing that, I the best state that had the best record was Georgia.
Georgia,
and the governor of Georgia was a guy named Jimmy Carter. So I went down to Atlanta. Five or six or seven times to get some of the information they had. And I got to know the governor a little bit. So we say goodbye, nothing went. I leave that and I go back to Washington. And a lot of my time was just spent around doing nothing. A lot of my time was just meeting people, going out for drinks, living in Washington, D.C., having a terrific time. But I kept thinking, you know, I really should be doing something
with your life,
with my life, because now I'm in my mid-30s and my life is going on. And I say, how long is this going to continue? And I didn't quite know what to do. So I thought maybe my life of success had coming to an end. So just then I get a phone call. So much of my life was other people. Asking me. And I get a call from Jimmy Carter, who was going to run for president, and called and asked me if I would work on his campaign, because the most important election in the primary, in the primary before the election, to show that, because he was from the South. He was from Georgia.
Georgia, yeah.
And he had approved to the money people and the other politicians in the North that a Southerner could win the Democratic primary. Because the Southerners then were always sort of put down and discarded and not really given too much of a thing.
Attention. Yeah.
So he needed somebody who knew Pennsylvania. And I knew Pennsylvania because I had just spent a year going all around the state finding business locations.
Yes, yeah. Mm.
So the next thing you know is I'm working on, and Jimmy Carter offered me, I said, so I fibbed a little bit. Mm-hmm. I did not tell the truth always. So Jimmy Carter calls me. He wants me to go to work on the campaign. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, I'm very busy here with my law practice, you know, in Washington, D.C. Because I was also able to practice law in Washington.
Oh, yeah.
I took the Washington bar and I passed it.
Mm.
So he said, well, can't I pay you to... He said, I said, well, you know, I'll lose all my clients if I leave now and all this other stuff. He said, well, how much are you making a month? So I just pulled out a figure that was just the most expensive, the highest that I could think of, which for then was a lot of money, $10,000 a month. So he said, done, I'll pay you.
What?
He said, I'll pay you. Can you be here to work on the campaign to Atlanta, Georgia? And I said... I can. When do you think you want me there? Mm-hmm. He said, tomorrow. He said, we're having our first meeting tomorrow. So I started working. I took a plane the next morning. I got on a plane in Washington, D.C., flew down to Georgia, rented a car, drove to Jimmy Carter's house, and there I was. So that's the kind of life I lived. I just got in the car and drove down there. I didn't know a soul. I'd never been to Georgia before in my life. I mean, it was... And I'd never worked on a presidential campaign before, except. So that was my whole life. That's the way things went.
Yeah.
Until I realized in 1980, he'd been president for 2 years. And I was working in the White House and working on lobbying the White House to Congress and things. It was an okay job. It was good for me. And I just woke up one morning and I got married. I thought, this is a good thing to do. So I dated a woman who worked in the same agency that I did. And the best part about dating her was that she loved to drink as much as I did. So I would go through a half or three quarters of a bottle of scotch a day, and so would she.
Wow, so it's like, it's equal, yeah.
Yes, and so we loved each other. And we did anyway, because it was a great relationship. But we loved to drink. So that makes it even better.
Yes, yes.
So I woke up one morning. I'm working. I have this ideal world. Success is all around me. I'm working in the White House. I mean, people try their whole lives to get a job working in the White House.
You have the job.
I have a wife. I have a nice house in Washington. Da, 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 da. I wake up one morning and I just said, I'm going to stop drinking. I just have to stop drinking. And that was like... That came out of nowhere for success, you know. And I just, through a series of circumstances, went to a group that was allowing me to stop drinking. And I just said, okay, I'm just going to do this for a little while, you know. And then
just to figure it out, like, and then...
Right, and then I'll go back to my other life. And the problem was my wife said, and after I came back from my first... experience with not drinking, she said, oh, that's terrific. Well, I think I should do that too.
Oh.
So she said, I want to do that too. So I'll go with you. And so now I can't get right. Now I can't get out of that. And I can't get away from the wife because I'm locked in with both of them. So I thought, okay, I'm just going to use this. So I took the whole year off. I went in to see Jimmy Carter. I said, I have to take a medical leave of absence. And I just took almost a year off and just didn't...
Do anything.
I ran the track at Georgetown University.
Wow.
I did other things. I read philosophy. And it was good.
Yeah.
And it was good. And then I said, all right, it's time to move back to Los Angeles. So I just picked up everything and moved back.
So it's sort of like you reach a point in your life where you say, like, now it's time.
Yeah.
to move on and to change directions. And I feel like that time you had, like, off gave you some little bit more perspective on where your life was going. Because you've reached, like, the mountain. And now you're, like, now trying to say, is this the mountain that I always dreamed of? Is this the view that I really wanted? And then you have to go down here and start all over again. How was it like to just reach on top and say that this is what I don't, I've reached there, but this is not exactly how I had envisioned it, and you have to go down the mountain to start again?
Well, it was a very, that's a very good question. Mm. And I didn't know. I just knew that it's almost as though there was something in the paraphysical, parapsychic world that just said, this is the time and this is what you have to do. You have to clear, it's like going to a chalkboard and clearing everything off of it. Yeah. That had, and everything on that chalkboard was what I had done in my life before.
Yeah. Erase it all.
Erase it all and start at the beginning again.
With a new page.
And that's why I said, okay, I'm going to move back to California. Mm. I just want to have a small life, just doing small little things and not have anything else to go on.
That,
and it was a very, it was almost a, something came to me and said, this is something that you must do now. So it was speaking to me. And so success sometimes, the paths of success sometimes come to you in dreams. They sometimes come to you in jobs that are offered to you. But for me, it was a series of different little things together that came and made it important.
That made it important.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So thank you very much, like, for sharing. Like, I think as we wrap up our... Like, you say that, what about those, like, as young people? Like, you know, like, when you had, like, some of your success, I was, like, you said, like, 25, and, like, you know, when you're growing up and getting all this. Like, well, as young people, we don't know what is going to happen in the future. Like, we're so anxious of... how am I going to be there? Like, you know, and living in LA where everyone seems to be successful at the very young age, how could we tame our souls or tame our expectations and make them more sort of grounded, like sort of be grateful every day for what we have and try to work as hard as possible to get to the next future? Like, how do we make sure that we are still living in today, but then not disbanding the future?
Well, that's a question that has a lot of different pieces to it. When you're younger, it's very hard to know if you're where that path is going to wind up. If you stay on it, are you being very solid and just following the path all the way, even though right now it's not good? Or is it the time to say, this is not the right path, I've got to jump off and go on another path? And I found that it's very difficult to know which one of the two that ever is. So what I did is I said, well, I've got to run my life so that I'm happy and that I'm contented with what I do. And a lot of that is being of service to other people. So, I mean, so I have a large family. My brother has four children, and my brother is not able to manage. He's in a an assisted care facility. So I've become almost a father in many ways, or an adult figure to four children. And now they're married, and they have spouses, and they have kids. And so things expand out. But I had to make sure that I was comfortable and that I was happy in what I was doing. So as long as I continued to do the kind of professional life that I do, which is a little bit of law and a little bit of politics and a little bit of community service, it all blends together in one thing. So I really like what I do, and I still like what I do very much. But I didn't know that I would like it until I had done it for a while. So I think for younger people, they have to go with where they, their heart is and with where their background is. If you don't like math, if you can't do math or chemistry or whatever, do not go into science.
Mm.
you know, this is not the field for you.
Yes.
You know, so certain things you know you shouldn't be doing, and other things you should say, I'm just going to try to do the best job that I can do and be the best person doing this kind of work.
Wow.
And see what happens. And you will know within 6 months or a year whether you'll be rewarded or not.
Wow. Yeah, so you sort of stick with it. Like,
yes.
You don't just, like as we're saying, like even though you have the cards, you still have to first play them the way they are.
Yep.
Until when you know that definitely this is not going to be the way the path is. But you don't, you just can't decide today when you just draw on the cards now and like, oh, I don't need them. Then you throw them and then you start again.
Yeah.
But you stick with it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
All right. Yeah.
So that is actually the way that I worked my life. Now, I don't know if that's an example for other people, but it's worked for me. I have a lot of experience doing a lot of different things, and I really can't say that there's very much of my life at all that I regret or that I look back on and say, I should never have done that. Wow. Everything I've learned something from that enables me to move to the next forward place.
Wow, yes. Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's what I do.
Thank you.
So the young people just have to take it. They have to have some gut feeling that what they're doing is what they like doing.
What they like doing and then stick with it.
Yep.
And continue doing what you do.
Yep.
And hope for the best.
Hope for the best. Yes.
All right.
All right. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much, Stuart.
All right. So we've come to the end of our episode. And so this is the poem that we have for today. We are who we are, simple, gentle, and proud. We are sons and daughters of those that born us. Millions of cells combined to make us. We are scared of the future. We know what is to come. We are scared of the past. History has never been our strongest password. Yet we don't know the present. It is hard to live with ourselves. Don't tell me that, for I think I know. Travelers on this journey called life, our destination unknown. Blinded by the bright stars, fixed on high roofs. Yet our paths are dark, nowhere to turn. We see that we can't be seen. The bottomless pit. Dangling on the strings of our thoughts are anomalies of life, tall like rogue pines. Bathed in seaweed and mud, sticky to touch. Arrange our thoughts, slot in the missing pieces, defining that we call scare, call those that come before us. Can we define success, the power that creates from nothing? We close our eyes, we can't see it. Yet when they are open, we only see ghosts and shadows. Success, they say, vanishes in the wind. Only the strong can catch it. Bigger are the two heads combined. Swift like an arrow, gentle like a river. Those that trek to the distant lands can find it, hiding in the crevices of our hearts. Only they know what it is wearing, a silk wedding dress. Thank you.